Welcome to the Prairie Producers Podcast. At Prairie Producers, we grow and process industrial hemp fiber into user-specified sizes, feeding American-grown hemp fiber back into the American supply chain. As the very first hemp fiber processor in the state of Minnesota, our goal is to provide hemp-related information and education. My name is Nicole Johnson. I am your host and business manager at Prairie Producers. In this episode, I interviewed Hunter Buffington, who is the executive director of the Hemp Feed Coalition. The coalition is a diverse set of stakeholders from across the United States and Canada. Their mission is to gain federal approval for hemp and its byproducts as animal feed to create new markets for farmers, processors, and feeders. As the executive director, Hunter utilizes her experience as well as her passion for data collection by working with regulators, policymakers, universities, nonprofits, and businesses to implement strategies for developing our emerging hemp industry. I hope you enjoy this episode as much as I enjoyed doing the interview. Hi, Hunter. Thanks for being here. I appreciate you taking the time, and I'm excited to learn more about the coalition. Before we get into that, though, let's maybe start with an introduction of yourself.
Okay. My name is Hunter Buffington, and I'm the executive director for the Hemp Feed Coalition. And we are a coalition that bridges multiple industries. So I work with hemp farmers, hemp processors, formulators, as well as regulators from across the United States and even into Canada. We also work with a lot of researchers, and I'll definitely spend some time talking about why that is and how important they are to gaining federal approval in this whole process. So the reason that the Hemp Feed Coalition was formed is because in 2018, there was a bill that went through the Colorado legislature to make hemp as an animal feed legal. And this is actually a question that I get all the time because a lot of folks say, well, why can't we just do it as a state legislative project? And I mean, you certainly can do it that way, but the reality is that legalization lies at the hands of the FDA, just like everything else in the hemp world. And then the Center for Veterinary Medicine is actually the department in the FDA that handles the approval of anything that goes into our animals. So not just on the feed side, but they'll also regulate any supplements or drugs that are designed for animal feed specifically. So when the legislature realized that they couldn't just legalize it at the state level, then they instead decided to do a stakeholder study. And they brought a lot of those folks eventually did become my constituents in the Hemp Feed Coalition, but they brought a lot of expertise from across the country. Again, those regulators, farmers, processors, folks like myself that worked for nonprofit hemp industry associations. At the time, I was working for the Colorado Hemp Industries Association as the executive director. Well, we could talk about that a little bit more in the history of the organization as well, but that was my introduction to the stakeholder group. And what the goal was for that stakeholder group was to identify and understand what the pathway to actual legal approval looked like, how long it was going to take, what were the resources that we needed in order to gain that federal approval, and then to literally make a step-by-step plan to get that done. And that actual document can be found on the Hemp Feed Coalition's website. So you can go in and see what that stakeholder group actually determined. And we really have stayed quite close to that plan simply because we're still trying to gain legal federal approval. Imagine that. Mm-hmm. Here in 2021 now, still working on that. And that is really, I think, the most painful aspect of my job is, you know, when I first started with the Hemp Feed Coalition 3 years ago, so 2018 was the publication of that stakeholder review document. And at the time, there was a recognition that, you know, that was a culmination of the work the stakeholder group did was this report. And no one was really ready to let go of the resources that had been developed, this roadmap to really gaining legal approval. And so COHIA was approached to begin the Hemp Feed Coalition. And so initially it was a program under COHIA, and then we also had a partner with Friends of Hemp, a Kentucky nonprofit, because we really wanted to emphasize that, you know, regional across the United States collaborative effort. It wasn't just here in Colorado that would be benefiting, right, from hemp as animal mm-hmm. feed. So I stepped into that role as program director for that under executive director for COHIA. And then just this last year in 2020, we decided to become our own standalone organization. And so I'm now the executive director for the Hemp Feed Coalition. But we're still doing all that same work. And when I began this job, the most common question I got was, is it going to get my cows high? And I thought that that was incredibly frustrating at the time to be like, no, I mean, it is cannabis sativa L, but let's talk about that. And so it was really a lot of focus on education, educating the farmers, even the regulators, because 88 years of prohibition has left just a huge gap in our understanding of this plant, both on the farming side, the processing side, just data. And we'll definitely talk some more about data, but the question I get asked most often now is an incredibly frustrated, why isn't it already legal,
mm-hmm.
right? Yeah. Why do we have to go through this? Now we know that it's not going to get our cows high.
So what part of the plant is used for feed? What varieties are we growing or are farmers growing? You know, we here in Olivia, we're growing for fiber. So we had 5 different varieties. How does that look different in the feed world? And then I'm just going to kind of ramble off a few questions and you can kind of take it and answer it however makes sense for you. But does it differ for poultry, swine, cattle? Is it a filler or a main source of feed? Is it replacing another commodity such as corn, or would it be in addition to, you know, the current feed that's out there? So kind of a lot all in one, but if you can just give us the big picture of what that looks like.
The first thing to know is that the primary goal of the Hemp Feed Coalition, first and foremost, is to gain legal federal approval for hemp as an animal feed. And then the secondary goal is to commoditize those byproducts, the waste products, if you will, that come out from the processing of the hemp plant into whatever it's going to be when it grows up. So really being able to solidify the supply chain, make sure that there is processing in place for all of those components, and then really help the farmers to stay in the game by making sure there's as many different streams of revenue for them as possible. So when we think about how we can use hemp and its byproducts for animal feed, there's a myriad of different ways. And I really want to say to folks that we haven't figured out exactly what all those possibilities are. And I would love to see our supply chain help guide us to figure out where the most economic benefits are. Mm-hmm. And my job is to really look at what the nutritional composition for these plant parts, right, or these mm-hmm. byproducts or waste material are, and how they could be applied for animal food. So the first thing to talk about is that the most common way that we have engaged with the hemp plant for millennia is fiber, just like you said. So a lot of times folks will say, well, there's, you know, the fiber plant is only used this part, right? We only use for the long fibers or the short fibers. Okay, well, what happens to the rest of that plant? Is there a stream of revenue or a place in the commodity supply chain where those byproducts would be valuable? So I want to put that question out there first and really have that be the frame at which we talk about what economic opportunities there are. So the second way that we're most familiar.
Can I put that into, can I just put that into kind of like a perspective on how I'm understanding that? So say we grow for fiber and we know we've picked the best variety that we know of for Minnesota for fiber. So instead of when we cut, instead of letting the grain and maybe the leaves just lay, we could harvest that before or after and utilize that. So that's kind of what you're saying. Is that correct? Okay.
Yep. Perfect. Exactly. Why wouldn't we commoditize what would be a byproduct for the fiber industry?
Mm-hmm.
So then on the grain side of it, oilseed is technically the right way to talk about it. But even the federal government will say grain and fiber, mm-hmm. right? But technically, you guys, it's a nut and an oilseed. So if you want to sound really smart, then let your friends know that it's an oilseed and a nut. And then they'll just think that you have read too many published articles about it. But when we think about the grain component, I mean, we have been eating this plant and feeding it to our animals for millennia. It was a commodity that farmers were paid to grow in the United States a few times Even prohibition was lifted so that we could produce hemp, in fact, for fiber during the war. And that's the Hemp for Victory campaign. If anybody wants to look it up, it's a great video from the way back talking about our relationship with this plant. So this is not a new nutrient for us. And, as I mentioned, it's also something that we have, in fact, been feeding. So for a long time, it's been well known that the protein content for hemp seed meal is very high. The primary market that we have been using in the United States that drives consumption has been oil crushed from those oil seeds that usually goes into human food. And in fact, there is a GRAS designation, so generally regarded as safe for three different hemp products for human consumption. And that's the oil, it's protein powder, and then it's the hemp parts, right? So we have had this relationship for a long time, but because of prohibition, there's this incredible lack of data. So I'm going to come back to that data question because that's a lot of how I spend my time. But because of the historical use of hemp, there is not a lack of any data that says what is a nutritional composition. But to answer more of the specifics of your question, when we look at all the different types of byproducts, so starting with something that's not a byproduct, so the whole seed itself, right? That is something that is available in wild bird seed, was never really prohibition as far as the use in the United States. We've had hemp seed in our wild bird seed, I think, for as long as we've been packaging wild bird seed.
Wow.
We know that poultry like it, they get some nutrients from it, and they, of course, like to eat those hard seeds. When we crush it for the oil, then we get a really dense calorie-boosting oil that has the right ratios of 3-6-9 fatty acids for humans, and that translates to a lot of mammals. Not all of them, but in general, it's going to be the essential fatty acids that we're getting in that hemp seed oil. So that's great for humans, and of course, it's also great for animals, especially if they need lots of groceries. So your performance horses, your mom baby pairs, right? Those are some of the applications for that dense, high caloric content, right? And then when you crush the seed, you get this extruded seed meal, which is got 10% of those same really healthy fats, and then 30% protein. So there's only a few feed sources that have that kind of nutritional profile. Now, when you think about all the applications, that's really where your finishing animals are going to be happiest or most likely to be fed that. But there's some unique qualities where things that specific carbohydrates or proteins that are found in the seed hulls may be really good for a specific species. For example, i.e. hogs. I haven't seen the research, so again, we'll get to that here in a hot second. But there's so many applications when we think about these, again, as waste and byproducts. Why are we not commoditizing them? And so part of that roadmap that was developed with the original stakeholder study was that we were going to start with seed and seed byproducts first as a way to introduce the FDA CVM to a product that they're more familiar with, right? They're not really too scared or too concerned about those seed products. And then identify if there was nutritional value in the post-extracted pulp material, right? So this is the plant biomass, which biomass means anything that is a biological mass material. So I want to help the industry to think about how we talk about things. Because when you say biomass, depending on who you're talking to, that has 50,000 different meanings, whatever the biomass is that you're talking about. So for our purposes of thinking of nutrition, it's best if we describe it as a pulp material. That's a very common food processing thing that happens with other commodities and other ingredients where you crush the material to pull out the oil or to pull out the juice, and then you have this post-extracted pulp material left over. So that we're finding is also incredibly nutritious, does have some of the residual cannabinoids, which make people take pause, but it's also one of the biggest nutritional benefits that we have. So there's so many things that we know about those waste products and this ingredient, but then there's so many things that we don't know. And Another application, of course, is bedding. When we think about the fiber side, if there's material that isn't giving you good long fibers or isn't consistent enough to be good biomass for building materials, right, then we need to be creative and think about what are the other ways that we can use this material.
I guess when we talk about like humans versus animals, why, and I'm kind of going maybe in two different directions, but why do you think, you know, all of these things have been approved for human consumption, but what's the holdup on the animal side? And then is that something that you guys are kind of working through in the coalition?
We're going to divide the research question is okay. That's where I live all the time. So the first thing, so let's back up just a little bit. So okay. A generally regarded as safe is not an actual approval. So a lot of folks will say, oh, it's already grass. That means it's approved by the FDA. No, there's nowhere on a grass designation or communication where it says approved. What it says is no questions, no concerns. Okay, so be advised that that's not an approval. And that's important because not every state recognizes grass. That's as true for humans as it is for animals. So there's a very different rigor that goes into actual approval of an animal or a human food ingredient. And I think most of your constituents, you yourself know that this has been an ongoing battle. FDA has not really, they're not really in the ring with us regulating these products. It's been a real challenge. So for me and for the Hempfeed Coalition, we work again with that Center for Veterinary Medicine. And we do have a good working relationship. We're communicating with them on a pretty regular basis. I think they really do want to see this approval happen as well. But there's a few different barriers, shocking, right? So one of the things that we identified is there's two pathways to gain federal approval for an animal feed ingredient. The first one is a feed additive petition. That goes directly to FDA CVM. That has to be submitted by a manufacturer or a formulator. And that provides some intellectual property controls in that type of application. It's not any more rigorous or less rigorous than a new ingredient definition, but because we are an industry association, not a formulator, we don't have any intellectual property that we're trying to protect, and rather our goal is to have as inclusive a definition as possible so that it can cover, you know, our processors and farmers across the United States. So we're working with AFCO, which is the American Association of Feed Control Officials. So AFCO allows industries like ourselves to submit a new ingredient definition. So that's the process I'm going to focus on really quickly. Try and make it as simple as possible. You probably saw the pathway to approval infographic that's on our website, and it took me 5 tries to try and get that as succinct as it is. And people that know the process have told me that I'm missing a few things, and I was like, you have no idea how difficult it was to try and get all that onto one image. So it's not all encompassing, but the idea is to give you, you know, some semblance of the process. So there's an ingredient investigator, that's where we start, and that depends on whether it's an oil seed, if it's a meal. There's a lot of different investigators in AFCO. Our investigator is the oilseed investigator for meal, because we're crushing the seed to extract the meal, and then we get the seed cake that's left over. She's at the Department of Ag in Montana. So it first goes to her. She looks over it, makes sure that the information is complete, and then it goes with the stamp of approval from AFCO onto FDA CVM, and then also to an ingredients definition committee that's part of AFCO. Both of those processes are gonna take us probably a year to get feedback. It's 180 days before FDA CVM has to respond. They're supposed to respond in 180 days. Based on my interaction with them, they will have more questions. That's just who they are as people and as an organization dedicated to the data collection, right? And then AFCO is in fact an organization that meets twice a year. So we've still got all these time parameters, data parameters that are gonna make it take some time. I mean, it's really 18 to 24 months from the submission of an application. Now, I am really excited because we did just submit to FDA-CBM from our investigator and to AFCO, the first hemp ingredient definition ever. So
awesome. Yeah, congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. It took longer than anybody thought it was going to. Shocking. But it's for seed meal and it's for laying hens. Okay. So at least now we can start feeding this ingredient. We still have a ways to go before we can say that the product is also safe for human consumption. So it's a huge process that we're going through. That takes me to the data side. So what the Hemp Feed Coalition does is we gather certificates of analysis from our farmers and processors across the United States. And that is actually so that we can put together a supplemental data set for FDA-CBM. This is a supplemental data set that they requested of us when we submit the applications. And this is because there's so much genetic variability, there's so much geographic variability, right? Mm-hmm. And we really don't know enough about this plant as a commodity because we've only been able to grow it for 5 years, right?
Right.
88 years of prohibition. And this is the reality is that we just don't have data. So this is one of the ways that your constituents can definitely help us out, which is by sharing any of those certificates of analysis on cannabinoid potency, any kind of nutritional analysis, any contaminant composition. And what we do with that is I take it in and we redact all of the submitter information. I assign it a sample ID number, and then it goes into our data set. And anyone who shares with me, then I'll share with them our complete data set. You can see what the averages are. What we've been requested to do is provide a statistically relevant sample size that from across the United States of American grown, American processed, right? And then we also have to follow up with American research. So we're gonna set that aside because that's like the part two of the application. So we generate this expanded data set, if you will, to show that there's consistency of this product across the United States. Then we also have to provide 5 to 7 non-consecutive lot numbers of material that we investigate all of those things. So the mineral content, the contaminant content, microbes, mycotoxins, heavy metals, residual pesticides, plus all the nutritional content, so that we can see it in each one of those very specific discrete samples. So there's 2 data sets that we have to provide in order to move forward with the application. In addition to that, it's the manufacturing description, it's the shelf life description, it's how is it treated or cleaned, or is there sanitizing steps, all of those things that we generate as the Hemp Feed Coalition, again, to be as inclusive of the industry as possible. We have to do that for every byproduct that we want to have approved. So hemp seed meal, it took us over a year to get all the certificates of analysis. That was the hardest part. And I'm working on oil right now, and we're also looking at pulp material right now. So I'm really excited. We got an APUC grant with one of our partner businesses in North Dakota, Healthy Oil Awesome. Seeds. So we've been able to secure the resources to do those 5 to 7 non-consecutive lot numbers, those really big investigations on those ingredients. So we can check that off the list. Awesome. Now we just need that data from across the United States for the rest of the ingredients.
So how do people get involved? I assume those certificates come from farmers, correct?
So yes, usually farmers and processors.
Farmers and processors. Okay, so if I were interested, what are the specifications that meet the criteria to start getting involved with this?
I like to encourage our farmers and processors to share tests that they're already utilizing. It's expensive to do these kinds of analysis on what is waste material or byproduct material. We absolutely understand that. I think that's part of the reason it took us so long to collect the data for the meal side. Now that we're doing oil, I think that there's probably a lot more folks out there who've been doing nutritional and contaminant testing on their oil because it is primarily used in the human food market. So we do need the certificates of analysis. I'll redact that information. But that's one of the biggest ways that folks can help. And, you know, like I said, we're working on oil now, but we've got pulp material. We're looking at sediment, also called butter, also called filtrate, if anybody's out there. We're also looking at hulls material, and then Flour, F-L-O-U-R. So think of that as like the screenings or fines. And that information is the best thing that folks can share with us. It's also incredibly helpful if they're willing to tell us what state it was grown and or processed in and what the varietal is. I know that we're all keeping really tight tabs on our genetic information, but everybody always asks me, what's the difference between varietals, right? Nicole, mm-hmm. that was on your list of questions.
Yep.
And I can't answer that unless people share with me that varietal information. And anything that you guys share with me, I will turn right around and share right back with you. So the more information you share with me, the better snapshot we're really gonna have of what this American agriculture commodity can look like and what it can do for us.
And would that be even if we're not feeding it to animals currently?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. Because we have to show to FDA CVM that the ingredient is homogeneous, that it's consistent across the United States. And I mean, there's a range, obviously. We can't say that it's always 33.3%, but rather we'll say, you know, 28 to 37% protein. Mm-hmm. And those are the kinds of information that we really need. The other thing, and this is where my work with FDA CVM overlaps with some of the work that USDA and even Agricultural Marketing Services are doing, because they want to know what happens with residual pesticides, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we've been talking with a lot of farmers who are traditional farmers that have done row crop agriculture for a really long time, and they're intrigued by hemp, right? They're interested to find out if it would be a good rotational crop. And the first question that USDA wants to know is, well, what happens on those lands that have been used with a lot of different pesticide applications for other crops, and how does hemp respond to that?
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of concern about this because we all love that hemp is a phytoremediator, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if we don't have the data that shows that the seed isn't impacted by that residual pesticides or even heavy metals, which are in our soils, right? They can be an intrinsic part of those soils, then we can't assure them that it's safe for animals to eat. So that's where that data really comes in. And we haven't even started talking about species. Like, Nicole, are you ready to talk about species and the rest of the data? Because that's like the first half of this application, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so we have to do that for every single ingredient. And by ingredient, I mean, if it differs in its manufacturing or nutritional content, then that's what's gonna make it a different ingredient.
Okay.
So now let's talk about species. In order to have a statistically relevant sample, 27, right? So keep that number in your head, 27. It's easy to round up to 30. I just round up to 30 every time. That's the cusp that we need as far as certificates of analysis. We've got to hit that 30 from across the United States. That's in addition to that discrete analysis where we look at everything. The same thing happens with our animal species. So just like how every single ingredient has to be investigated, every single species and category of species also has to go through a clinical feed trial to show safety and efficacy. What that means is that you need 30 animals that are not getting fed hemp, right?
Mm-hmm.
30 animals that are getting fed the intended amount that you want to give them. So for example, if you wanted to give them 20% of hemp protein, that would be your X. And then you need 30 animals that are on 2X to show that there's no safety or toxicity concerns when it's being fed twice as much. And then on a 0.5X so that they can compare the X and the 0.5X. So that's 120 animals, right? Four different rations and 120 animals. And this starts to give you an idea of why it's so expensive to conduct these trials. You add to that that we really want principal investigators who are species experts to be the ones that are doing these trials, looking at anti-nutritives, watching for any of those toxicity or safety concerns. We really don't want to conduct a trial and then find out that there's some data point that we can't explain, because we know that FDA CVM is going to see it, right? If there's one little thing that's a little mm-hmm. bit off in these trials, they're definitely going to be looking for that. So in addition to that, when we think about finishing animals, right? So these are the animals that are going to come into the human food chain. that's a category of animal. And of course, there's round backing, there's finishing, there's a myriad different ways that we finish production animals. And then we've got things like our cow-calf pairs, our sow litters. And that's a different category of animal and requires a different clinical feed trial. So to put things in perspective, you know, there's this ingredient component, which is half of the application. And then we're going to have to repeat the other half of the application for all those categories and for each different species. And you heard me at the beginning of the call. I was really excited. We got the first one in and it was for hemp-fed laying hens.
Awesome.
You know, and again, that's when folks are like, why is this taking so long? And it's the best explanation I have is because that was the very first application. And because we only want laying hens. Of course it wasn't. We wanted to do everything all at once, but it's not an option. We are working on a ruminant application, lambs, goats, and beef cattle. And then we've got some partners that are working on a swine study also with meal, but they're monogastrics, not ruminants. So very different study. Mm-hmm. And then we are working on an oil for horses trial as well, because they're the ones that need those groceries, really benefit from that as a top dress. So we got a few irons in the fire. We've got a number of principal investigators, really those animal experts that are working with us to figure out how to get all of these studies done. And if there's anybody out there that, you know, really has a favorite university, I don't know, like Texas A&M or Colorado State, my alma mater, or a favorite species or a favorite ingredient, and you are really excited to help us move this project forward, let me know. I think I've got a university or an animal for everyone.
That's awesome. When you said 120 animals for a study, are those 120 animals on the same lot or in the same barn, on the same pasture, or are they spread across the U.S.?
That's a great question, because anytime that there's a difference or a deviation in those study groups, then it makes it harder. And one of the big issues when I started way back when, and this was identified again in that stakeholder group, was that there was a real discouragement of using university researchers. And I really dug into that because I felt like the only way we were ever going to get this done was to get partnerships with as many different universities and really engage and utilize that intellectual capital that's at our universities. That and the enthusiasm for the grad students and the students out there that wanted to help drive the exploration of hemp. And so part of the reason that there was a real pushback was because of a lack of really strict clinical protocols and methods, right? So FDA would say in a clinical trial facility, everything is exactly the same. The rigor to make sure that there's nothing that deviates is right there. You're not gonna have to worry about a freak snowstorm. It keeps everyone from getting to the animals, right? Because they're in this lockdown facility. So we really did push to get our universities engaged in this process. And one of the ways in which we choose researchers to partner with is their willingness to engage with the FDA CVM. So those researchers that are willing to work with us, submitting methods and protocols to FDA CVM, sitting in pre-submission meetings and really working with us to hopefully save time and save money by being efficient as possible. Those are the folks that we're really looking to partner with.
So when I was looking at your website, I noticed the team is just phenomenal. There was way more people involved than I was expecting. So
yeah.
I assume you guys come from all over the place. You're kind of working, you know, within obviously your scope of vision. Maybe just explain how each member kind of found its place, and maybe not each individual person, but how that all fell into place. And then the second question, I know you've mentioned an investor and the investigator and things like that, but are you on a continuous basis looking for, you know, investors, or are you out doing, you know, something to kind of raise funds and raise capital for just to keep moving forward? So I know, two loaded questions, but...
No, they do interact really well. So when we first began, of course, we were a program, right? So we didn't need a board of directors. However, we're very much an agricultural research entity. the end of it, that's again how I spend most of my time, is identifying experts and bringing in as much data as I can to be able to analyze that data and present it to the FDA, right? And of course, we're building a huge body of understanding for this ingredient and this plant that just haven't been done in the United States before. So when we first formed, we really just needed a large group of coalition members that could bring that expertise, right? And it's no small thing that we're called a coalition. And I think that that's a word that's maybe used too often for a handful of people, right? But if we're going to really be a coalition representing the hemp industry, regulators, and the animal feed industry, that can't just be five people. And it can't just be people from Colorado and Kentucky, right? We've got to have some diversity in expertise and industry representation. And also because the Canadian Hemp Trade Alliance is doing the same thing with at the same time that we are. And the reality is that most of the hemp that's been imported into the United States, it's coming from our North American neighbor. There's some real advantages to working together. And I don't want people to be fearful, like, oh, I thought it was, you know, United States-based. But the reality is that the demand that we're talking about in the animal feed industry is massive. Mm-hmm. And the easiest way to kill a new industry is to overpromise and undersupply. Or oversupply and underdeliver because there's no market for it. So mm-hmm. I hope that we've really learned that lesson. And that's a big reason why we're working with our Canadian brethren, is that there are things that we have that are an advantage for us on this side of the border, and things that they have or knowledge they have that are also an advantage. So that was the purpose of the steering committee, was to identify those industry experts, those researchers, the folks that really could bring to the table those resources, right? And, mm-hmm. and a lot of that is in fact knowledge and expertise. And then when we decided that we were gonna become a formal organization, we then, of course, had to have the governance of a board of directors. Sure. And so our board of directors is nominated from our steering committee. So these are folks that, you know, the steering committee really hears what happens in the work groups. So for folks to really engage, the best way is to become a member. It's $100. You can go to the website. You just donate $100. I will monitor that and I'll pull you in. You'll get included on our newsletter. We have a special members only newsletter. There's discounts, 15% off Eurofins testing, as well as invitations to events, things that only the members are gonna see. And then you also have the opportunity to sit on a work group. And so we have a production animals work group, we have an equine work group, we have an ingredients work group, and we have a policy work group. So that's where our members, again, if we're gonna call ourselves a national coalition, we've got to be able to be representative of yeah. what that looks like. And then the steering committee is a group of folks that have either been in the industry at a high level or been with the coalition for a long period of time that can lend that expertise. And they help to really review all of the data and all the information that's coming in and make those recommendations to the board as needed. And then the board handles the day-to-day operations. So that's why when you look at the website, you're like, oh, there's a board and there's a steering committee. Oh, and there's work group members. And it's really our way of trying to ensure that we really are the voice of the industry. Mm-hmm. You know, if we don't have enough voices, then how can we try and really represent everyone? It's a challenge. But at the same time, we're dependent on the industry to also share their knowledge. Mm-hmm. These certificates of analysis is the foundation of us getting this approval. So we're really in it together, and hopefully there's lots of value for folks to become members. And we wanted it to be accessible to everyone as well. So that's that $100 annual membership to make sure folks can join mm-hmm. us if they would like to. So we're looking for champions, and champions have traditionally been ingredient and species specific. So for example, our biggest champion right now has been IND Hemp. They are also our board president. Ken is the president of their company, and he sits on our board. So there isn't a direct relationship between champions and board positions. It doesn't work that way. However, there's nothing like having a champion on your board, someone who is really excited about the mission, excited enough to spend the money to host the lamb trial that was here at CSU.
Awesome.
Big deal. Also championed the completion of the application, which of course that was for chickens, but the goal there was to get Neil on its way.
Mm-hmm.
And we do have some smaller champions, some folks that are focused on beef cattle. Imagine that. We also have the APUC champion, that's healthy oil seeds, that helped us to secure those lab analysis that's going to come from Eurofins. Eurofins is our partner. So we also have strategic partners, and a strategic partner helps with the mission of the organization, whereas a champion is going to help specifically with that application, that ingredient, or that species. And I will tell you guys out there listening that we really are pushing to get this equine trial moving forward. And it's a lot less expensive than folks might think it would be. For example, you know, that trial for the horses is under $150,000. And the average trial for these animals, and remember, we're talking about 120 animals, the average trial is $250,000.
Wow.
And that's not the application, right? That's just the trial. That's not the work that I do, or the lab analysis, which can also be quite expensive. But the, you know, every bit helps. Mm-hmm. But again, if there's somebody out there that says, I want to feed my pigs hulls, I have a project for you.
I love that. Well, that brings me into my last question. Where can our listeners find you? How can they connect with you? What are all the options, and what's the best option?
Yeah, so the website is definitely one of my favorite things. I'm really excited about that. We revamped it just the end of last year, and I love it. We're working really hard to make sure that if you visited it last week and you visited it again this week, that there's something different for folks to visit or to see on that website. You can make your $100 donation. That's all you gotta do to become a member. So that's really fantastic. There's some great resources on the press release pages, stuff about us, as well as things, you know, there's a couple articles in there that I think are pertinent to the industry. So that's a great way. My email is hunter@hempfeedcoalition.org. And any farmers or processors out there, champions, folks that just want some more information, definitely send me an email. You can always send a message on the website too. And we do have a team, so you might not always get directly to me unless you use my email. But there's a few of us that are excited to talk to folks. And then, of course, we have social media. So social media is not always a great direct engagement, but it'll give you a way to connect with us and stay up to date. And then you can also sign up for our email blast on the website. But social media outlets, we have a Facebook, we have Instagram, we have LinkedIn, and we have Twitter.
Awesome. Well, that's what I've got, unless you have anything else that I maybe didn't ask you or that I missed.
There's anything. I mean, I guess the excitement over this first application, just driving this effort forward. And there's so many ways that folks can help, you know, those certificates of analysis. If you want to volunteer an hour of your time once a month, and you want to engage with us, we'll find a way. And of course, there's a lot of ways that champions get access to data that just nobody else is gonna see. So if you are interested in helping to drive this initiative forward, let me know. I'm sure we can think of something.
Awesome. And that's really cool. So I mean, it's essentially a reward to them for being involved. They get all that knowledge and all that wisdom back. So that's really cool. I like that. Well,
nice.
Thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Nicole.
Thank you for listening to the Prairie Producers Podcast. You can find us on our website at prairieproco.com, on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, and YouTube. You can also contact us directly at nicole@prairieproco.com. We'd love to hear from you, and we hope you continue to follow us on this journey of reconnecting hemp fiber and agriculture.